Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Leonard Rubinstein, Executive Director of Physicians for Human Rights, who describes the alleged massacre of hundreds of Taliban prisoners at the hands of U.S. allies during the recent Afghanistan war and his call for a U.N.-supervised investigation. Raj Patel, Policy Analyst with the Institute for Food and Development Policy, who examines the obstacles that are hindering progress on poverty eradication and environmental protection at the World Summit on Sustainable Development, which got underway in Johannesburg, South Africa, on August 26th. And Doris Granny D. Haddock, the 92-year-old activist who walked across America to fight for campaign finance reform, discusses the struggle to restore and revive U.S. democracy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Nation magazine reports that a U.S. district court is considering the prospect of putting the drug giant Pfizer on trial in the U.S. for overseeing botched drug testing on Nigerian children with meningitis. The class action suit was filed last summer on behalf of 30 Nigerian families who alleged that Pfizer violated the Nuremberg Code for coercing sick children to take experimental drugs and later suffered from brain damage, loss of hearing, paralysis, and even death. Pfizer thought it had a golden opportunity to test a prospective antibiotic drug, Trovan, in 1996 when a severe outbreak of meningococcal meningitis hit Nigeria. The drug trials consisted of giving the experimental medicine to 100 extremely ill children to see how Trovan worked against a rival medication, Rocephin, which had been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. The suit against Pfizer charges the drug company did not tell the families that their children were taking an experimental drug or that alternative treatment was available at a nearby Doctors Without Borders clinic. The lawsuit also claims that Pfizer doctors failed to arrange adequate follow-up visits with the sick children and kept no records of how many children became deaf, brain damaged, or died. Many American shoppers know the brand Bonita, the Spanish word for beautiful, labeled on bananas and other fruit at big supermarkets. The Bonita brand is owned by Alvaro Noboa, Ecuador's biggest banana exporter and a presidential candidate in Ecuador's upcoming election. Along with his wealth, Noboa has also won a reputation in Ecuador for paying sub-minimum wages and repressing unions with brute force. In March, 1,400 banana workers formed a union at 7 of Bonita's plantations located near Ecuador's Pacific coast. The demands were simple: enrollment in the country's national health plan, wages equal to the national minimum wage, and recognition of the union. Instead of negotiation, the banana baron fired pro-union workers and laid off workers employed on temporary contracts. On May 6, the banana workers went on strike. According to the news magazine In These Times, the company then brought in 400 hooded armed men to threaten and rough up the strikers. One report claimed the workers were dragged out of their beds and beaten up. Threats were also made that strikers would be killed and dumped in the river. Quickly, Bonita pronounced that the strike was over and the harvest of bananas would continue. A recent report by Human Rights Watch documented that the average daily wage of a banana worker is 41 cents below the minimum wage, and it takes two incomes for a family to meet its basic needs. Underscoring the desperate situation, children of farm workers go to work on average at age 11. Forbes magazine reports that Bruce Babbitt, the Clinton administration's Secretary of Interior, is back in the middle of the debate over fighting forest fires, this time as a lobbyist for an industry heavyweight. According to insiders, Babbitt was hired earlier this year by Firetroll, the Phoenix-based company that makes most of the fire retardant used by the U.S. Forest Service in fighting forest fires. The product is controversial because it contains sodium ferrocyanide, an agent that a recent federal study found kills fish and frogs under certain conditions. A rival company, Asterisk, makes a retardant that does not use this cyanide compound and could win a competitive battle with Firetroll if the U.S. Forest Service phases out the use of sodium ferrocyanide by 2004 as planned. A study by the U.S. Geological Survey in 2000 led the U.S. Forest Service to craft a new rule calling for firefighters to stop using the cyanide-based fire retardant within 300 feet of lakes, rivers, and streams. Yet most environmentalists say the rule is nearly impossible to follow in the midst of fighting intense wildfires on federal lands. New studies on the retardant are expected to be released soon, and they will determine the final status of sodium ferrocyanide. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
In early 2002, members of the Boston-based group Physicians for Human Rights examined what appeared to be a mass grave in northern Afghanistan. Forensic experts estimate that the site may contain more than 1,000 bodies. Eyewitnesses have told investigators that the dead buried there are Taliban prisoners who surrendered to the U.S.-allied Northern Alliance forces in the city of Kunduz in late November 2001. Newsweek magazine, in their August 26th cover story titled The Death Convoy of Afghanistan, recounted the stories of multiple witnesses and their accusation that Northern Alliance commander General Abdul Rashid Dostum murdered as many as 2,000 to 3,000 Taliban and foreign prisoners by means of suffocation, sealing them inside cargo containers without water or food. No information has yet surfaced directly implicating U.S. armed forces in this massacre, but questions remain as to what the Pentagon may have known and when. Physicians for Human Rights has called on the Bush administration, the Afghan government, and the United Nations to secure the mass gravesite at Dasht-e Leili and conduct a thorough criminal investigation. But thus far, there has been no movement to initiate such an inquiry. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leonard Rubinstein, executive director of Physicians for Human Rights, who describes the alleged massacre in Afghanistan and the special obligation of the U.S. to hold accountable its ally, which may be guilty of committing this war crime.
Go back and recall back in the fall of 2001 when the Northern Alliance forces allied with the United States had the Taliban on the run in northern Afghanistan. And in two battles at Mazar-e-Sharif and Kunduz, many thousands of Taliban surrendered to the Northern Alliance forces. And what happened after that is not exactly known. We know that a few thousand, maybe 3,500 prisoners were brought to a place called Shebargan Prison. And it was there that U.S. Special Forces or other military interrogated prisoners to identify those who were identified as possibly associated with al-Qaeda, and they're the ones who were eventually brought to Guantanamo. But there were many, many thousands more who are unaccounted for. And the Newsweek story, which was independent of Physicians for Human Rights, was based on interviews with truck drivers, with soldiers, with many others in the region. And they allege that hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, some maybe over 1,000, were transported to the prison in sealed container trucks, and they suffocated in those trucks. And it's a very disturbing story. Now, where Physicians for Human Rights comes in is back in January, some of our investigators who were in the region discovered a mass grave, and in February, we sent a forensic anthropologist who does specialized work for Physicians for Human Rights on death investigations, and he confirmed that it was a mass grave. Of course, it needed to be investigated, the real story of how many people were killed, the circumstances of their death, and possibly the identification of the perpetrators could be located by an exhumation of those graves. And so since about March, we have been calling on the UN, on Afghanistan, on the United States to provide, number one, protection for the site so that it wouldn't be tampered with, and secondly, for an investigation. And it was a frustrating 5 months while nothing was happening. And then the Newsweek story last week brought the issue to world attention again by the incredible testimonial evidence that the Newsweek journalists had collected.
Throughout your discourse with the U.S. government and the Pentagon, have the Pentagon officials specifically been forthcoming? Have they been honest about their role here and what they knew and the presence of U.S. soldiers at the time these prisoners were loaded into these cargo containers, later suffocated to death?
The position of the Pentagon from the start has been that U.S. soldiers were not either present or aware of what was happening. The Newsweek story does not implicate American troops. The story tends to suggest that they may well have been aware of what either happened after the fact or perhaps while it was going on, but the evidence of that is less clear. But the Pentagon has been in complete denial.
What would you like to see the Bush White House and the Pentagon do at this point?
Well, you have to understand that this is one of the most extraordinary and largest war crimes in the history of involvement by United States forces in terms of numbers, if their allied forces were involved. So we think it's really essential that the facts be found, and that means a full investigation. We think to be credible and to be effective, it should be under the auspices of the United Nations, and of course with the participation of Afghan human rights investigators. We think they may have an important role to play, but we don't want to saddle an impoverished country with no resources to do this.
The Bush administration has fought very hard to seek immunity from prosecution from the newly formed International Criminal Court, and certainly the fact that the United States potentially has some involvement in this investigation into a massacre, it seems that the point is very clear that the United States has to be a party to institutions like the International Criminal Court, or else the U.S. is standing alone above the law.
You made a lot of important points. One is that there isn't any evidence to date that anybody from the United States is implicated in any war crime. On the other hand, a force that was directly and closely allied with the United States is potentially implicated. And if there were an international institution like the criminal court, a full investigation would have to be conducted. And you couldn't say, well, we're going to investigate everything but the United States or every person except Americans, even though we don't expect the evidence to show any liability for an American or a soldier. You can't cut off the possibility of such an investigation. So, yes, it does show how difficult it is to draw the lines that the administration wants to draw. I think we as Americans are proud of a tradition of adherence to the rule of law. We're proud of holding people accountable for crimes, and we're especially proud of being intolerant of war crimes, as difficult as it was, for example, during the Vietnam War, the My Lai incident. Americans were held to account for it eventually. So we have a strong tradition, so I think it's very detrimental to our own values not to participate.
That was Leonard Rubinstein, Executive Director of Physicians for Human Rights. Contact the group by calling area code 617-695-0041 or visit their website at www.phrusa.org. In the days before the kickoff of the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg, South Africa on August 26th, landless activists from around the globe took to the streets to draw attention to the connection between poverty and landlessness. More than 70 of those protesting were arrested by police, symbolizing to many the lack of access to the summit for representatives of civil society who have come to Johannesburg to challenge development policies advocated by government and corporate leaders. The World Summit on Sustainable Development comes 10 years after the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, where delegates recognized the rapid destruction of the planet's environment and the link with growing poverty. Critics charged that many of the pledges made in Rio have been broken or watered down. Expectations for progress in Johannesburg have been diminished by a dispute over the summit's agenda, which includes no new treaties or binding commitments. President Bush's decision not to attend the summit and his refusal last year to sign the Kyoto Treaty, negotiated to reduce the production of greenhouse gases, have been a lightning rod for criticism of America's lack of leadership. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Raj Patel, policy analyst with the Institute for Food and Development Policy, or Food First, who examines the obstacles that are hindering progress on global poverty eradication and environmental protection.
In principle, the World Summit on Sustainable Development is a noble and admirable sort of institution. It's a stated task is to feed the poor and save the earth. But what actually seems to be happening in Johannesburg is a situation of carving up the earth to feed the rich. And that, in fact, has every connection with the Rio Summit, the Rio Earth Summit that happened 10 years ago. Rio had all the potential to launch us into a more sustainable and just and equitable world. But basically what happened is that Rio blew up on the launch pad. It was sabotaged by corporate interests and rich governments. And so despite all the sort of hoo-ha and excitement in the lead-up to Rio in 1992, the document that came out of that summit, instead of talking about the issues that really matter for sustainable development, such as land reform or protection for small farmers or the issue of overconsumption in the U.S. and elsewhere, what the Rio Declaration told us was that markets and corporate partnerships were going to save the earth. And it was a very disappointing outcome. The UN Secretary General at the time, Boutros-Ghali, said, one day we will have to do better. And that day doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon, because what's happening at Johannesburg is essentially the same sorts of things, where corporations have edged their way into the WSSD process. And it looks like corporations are going to be the only groups that come away from the summit with anything approaching something that makes them happy.
There have been a number of protests that have occurred in the days before the summit opened. Maybe talk about what's happened on the streets of Johannesburg and what the message is of those protesters.
On the streets, say last Thursday, there were 3,000 people who were marching in protest against their evictions from the suburbs in Johannesburg. And they've been evicted because they can't afford to pay the privatized rates for electricity and water. And the South African police very brutally repressed that demonstration. They fired tear gas into a crowd of women and children as well as men protesters. 72 people were arrested and 3 were quite badly injured. And what the protesters were essentially saying is, look, sustainable development means talking about difficult issues like poverty, like land reform, like the right to access electricity and water. And what the South African government was saying rather clearly is that actually, no, we don't want to talk about that. And we will silence you pretty much by any means necessary. And that sort of repression seems to be characterizing a lot of these global summits. I mean, people who want to talk about poverty, who want to assert their democratic rights, are repressed by the host government because these issues are too awkward to be discussed in a democratic forum.
Raj Patel, what can you tell us about the groups that are gathering under the banner of civil society and challenging the kind of status quo that government and corporate leaders have established at these large international summits to tackle these big issues?
Civil society is an odd term. There's certainly a spectrum of groups who represent civil society. You have grassroots groups such as the Landless People's Movement and the National Land Committee from South Africa. The actions that they've managed to do so far involve getting electricity, squatting in urban areas that they've been dispossessed from, and actually reclaiming land. So groups like that, grassroots groups such as the Landless Peasant Movement, are not only quite successfully challenging the status quo, but they are out in force at the Johannesburg Earth Summit. There don't seem to be any binding agreements that will come out of this conference that will in any way improve the situation of the majority of people in the third world, largely because the U.S. doesn't want to commit to anything that runs counter to the World Trade Organization model of development. So what you have as a poverty-relieving strategy is, again, the idea that, well, poor countries should open up their markets and through trade liberalization and through trading away and exporting one's way out of poverty, the environment and poverty magically will be righted. It's only through these sorts of large-scale demonstrations that we can begin to think about what we want the alternative to look like and how we can strategize about and make happen the sorts of world that genuinely does feed the poor and save the earth. At the moment, the Johannesburg conference doesn't look terribly promising, but the civil society groups that are genuinely grassroots are putting forward alternatives, are suggesting ways for small farmers to be able to live and to be able to fight back. Yes, these big summits are inevitably disappointing, and we do need to send a message to the people who would try and govern us. But also, it's important to organize locally and to inform oneself and develop alternatives locally. And they are happening. There is hope.
That was Raj Patel, policy analyst with the Institute for Food and Development Policy, or Food First. Contact the group by calling area code 510-654-4400 or visit their website at www.foodfirst.org. Campaign finance reform is an issue at the heart of contemporary U.S. politics and American democracy, or the lack of it. Yet the subject makes most people's eyes glaze over. That was also true of Doris Haddock, a self-described little old lady from a small town in New Hampshire, until she heard something a few years ago that changed her life. She was outraged to learn that lobbyists had tried to sneak a $50 billion credit for the tobacco industry into an unrelated piece of legislation. Although she had been active in other grassroots efforts, Haddock had not known of the abuses of the campaign finance system. That incident helped transform Haddock into Granny D, the 92-year-old who walked across the country in 1999 and 2000 to promote campaign finance reform. Her remarkable journey and the people she encountered in cities and small towns across America are recounted in her book titled Granny D, Walking Across America in My 90th Year. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Haddock at the Grassroots Radio Conference in August, where she was a keynote speaker. She describes her transformation and the impact her walk had on herself, others, and the fight for campaign finance reform.
I was a little old lady, 89, living in a little village of 1,400, a member of the planning board, a deacon in the church, voted, paid my taxes, so I thought that I was a good citizen. But when I called Common Cause, the office that had put this notice in the paper, and asked what in the world is going on, they said, well, don't you understand about the corruption that we have in this country today? And I said, what corruption? I said, isn't this an unusual thing? They said, no, not really. But it was caught, so don't worry about it. I said, well, I am going to worry about it. They told me the buzzword was campaign finance reform. So I began cutting clippings out of various papers and making a scrapbook. And in a year's time, I had two great big scrapbooks just full of campaign finance reform that I had always ignored as much as other people do because it didn't mean anything to me.
So you walked across the country, you met people all over, you spoke at many rallies. I read your book. It seems like you created quite a stir. You skied into near Washington at the end when it snowed and you couldn't walk. You've certainly been an inspiration. That was over 2 years ago when you finished in February of 2000. You finished your walk across the country. So how do you think your walk had an effect, if any, on the campaign finance reform bill that we finally got this past year, the McCain-Feingold bill?
Well, I think I helped it get passed. I mean, I was told that I had put a face. This is what McCain said. She had put a face on the bill. She made people aware of what was going on. And when it came time, people rallied and kept that phone ringing at the end so that people would know that in the Senate and the House that they wanted that bill to pass.
Do you think that the campaign finance reform bill, the McCain-Feingold bill, and the companion Shays-Meehan bill in the House, now that they're signed into law, that it will make a difference? Do you think it's strong enough to make a difference?
I don't think it's a very strong bill. I think that in order to pass it, they changed the amount of money, hard money, that they doubled. Before it was, you could give $1,000, now it's $2,000, and that was an awful slap in the face. But if they were going to pass it, you know, politics is compromise. But I think that was too big a compromise, but it seemed like that was the best they could do. And now, the FEC, do you know what the FEC is? The FEC is a Federal Election Commission, and they get the bill after it has been signed by the president, and they're supposed to clarify the language so that anybody reading it would understand what it means. But that isn't what they're doing. They're tearing it apart. And so when they get through with it, it's not going to be even as good a bill as it was if they're allowed to get away with what they're doing.
So what are you doing? I understand you've been doing some campaign finance reform work, walking in some individual states in favor of changes in the state laws?
Yes. Now, we have four states that have public funding, and we have two states that have used it in one election and think that it is wonderful. It's better than sliced bread, both in Maine and in Arizona. But in Massachusetts is having difficulty getting it into play, and Vermont is going to have it this next election. My feeling is that there's been a great many good things that we have in this country that started in the states. There are 40 of 50 states working on this, working for public funding. And if you get a critical mass, if enough states are able to get started, then it will spread to federal. I think that's the only answer. The people that are in the House and in the Senate today have been elected under the present system, and they know no other.
Just kind of summarize what you learned from that experience, walking across country, meeting people all along the way, talking about campaign finance reform.
It is never too late to get in shape. It is never too late to go and look for a new adventure. If you have a dream, there's no reason why you can't go ahead and fulfill that dream.
That was Doris Haddock, also known as Granny D. For more information, visit her website at www.grannyd.com. Her book, Granny D, Walking Across America in My 90th Year, is published by Villard Books. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.